You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
They've just launched a hypersonic missile because it's the only thing that they can get through with absolute certainty.
The White House confirms Russia's use of hypersonic missiles as Ukrainians in Mariupol refuse to surrender. Meanwhile, in Bulgaria, the country straddles a difficult line between East and West. We'll get the details from Sofia. We'll also find out the latest on the passenger plane crash in China, thought to have killed over 130 people. And we'll ask why South Korea's president-elect is relocating the presidential office. Does the Blue House have bad feng shui? Then...
Somebody came up with, shouldn't Eurovision be in the US?
No, you said that.
Well, Eurovision is in the US now, sort of. It's called the American Song Contest, and we'll learn more about it. With a rundown of the front pages and the current television news, that's all to come here on The Globalist, live from London. Almost a month into Russia's war on Ukraine, Mariupol is still refusing the demand that it surrender. Hundreds of thousands of people remain trapped in this strategic southern port city on the Sea of Azov, which has been deprived of food, water and electricity for weeks. For the latest, I'm joined by Vladislav Devzon, who is author of From Odessa with Love and a fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Aglaya Snetkov, who's a lecturer in the international politics of Russia at UCL and author of the book Russia's Security Policy Under Putin. Thank you both very much for joining us today. Vladislav, what's the latest situation in Mariupol?
Hi, thank you for having me back. Mariupol is... It already does have a ongoing humanitarian catastrophe. It is extraordinarily sad. The city, according to the mayor, has been leveled to the ground. We're told by the mayor of the city that 80% of the housing stock is destroyed. We are told that much of the infrastructure is destroyed. We are told that people are starving and they're running out of water. They are, some of them, the civilian population, women and children and the elderly are leaving, but the siege around Mariupol that the Russians have put on is brutal and vicious and is only getting worse as they continue to try to starve out the city, as the deadline that they've imposed on the leaders of the city to evacuate it and to surrender is about to come to us.
And Aglaya, why is Mariupol so important to Russia?
So it's important for sort of a number of reasons. And I think it's interesting because for all that there was an assumption that Russians would go to, you know, target the cities, they haven't. Actually, Mariupol is one of the few. So it's important strategically. It creates a sort of a land corridor between Crimea and Donbass. And so it allows sort of Russian side to go deeper into the West and to connect Crimea, which had been disconnected up till now. It is an economic hub for Ukraine. It does have sort of the steel plants, for example, that was hit and destroyed, the biggest European steel plant that has been hit and destroyed around Mariupol. I think it's also important sort of symbolically. There's been a lot of talk about the Azov Battalion, which is said to be home in, around Mariupol. And, you know, it would show that the Russians are able to make progress effectively. It would also enable the Russians to further their eastwards advance and potentially to encircle the Ukrainian troops.
Mm. Vladislav, I wonder how significant the use of hypersonic missiles is.
Well, it's really bad, of course, from the standpoint of civilians and from the signaling standpoint of what else you could be putting on those missiles in terms of non-conventional warheads. Clearly, you can be putting chemical or even nuclear biological warheads on those hypersonic missiles. It's also a sign of desperation in a sense that the Russians have not been able to achieve their objectives, their military objectives with conventional arms or the usage of ground forces. It's a really incredibly frightening thing, of course, for civilians all across the country.
Aglaya, we're also seeing worrying reports of Ukrainians being transported to Russia. What's the detail on that?
I've not heard much more about those people. There are lots of reports of torture by Russian occupation forces and Russian occupation troops. And obviously, it's an incredibly frightening thing. It's definitely a hostage situation. And, you know, could it be a concentration camp situation? We don't know.
Aglaya, do you know much more about that?
So there was talk about the Russians evacuating civilians, which essentially means sort of women, children and the elderly to Russian cities. Now, there have been reports, there have been sort of, you know, Twitter chatter about it. I'm not sure at this stage that I have seen many reports about sort of them arriving and their state of play, but there have been talk and discussions about Russians moving and evacuating too. I mean, this is part of the general discussion about humanitarian corridors put up by the Russians and suggesting that they can evacuate Ukrainian civilians into Belarus and Russia. So it's part of this sort of wider process of essentially offering to move Ukrainian civilians into Russia, which has obviously been pushed back by the Ukrainian administration.
Mm. I mean, we know that a quarter of Ukrainians have left their homes. Vladislav, many of those are heading to Poland. I know you're in Warsaw. What's the impact on the city there?
Yes. I'm indeed in Warsaw, and there's 250,000 Ukrainians in the capital and 2 million reported in Poland. I'm walking around Warsaw reporting, seeing people, seeing political elites, seeing members of a Polish and Ukrainian political class. And it's utterly amazing how much Russian and Ukrainian one hears in the streets, in the hotels. That Warsaw is up in arms for Ukraine, and there are posters of solidarity everywhere, literally sometimes three on a block or three on a single city building. But there's just so much Russian and Ukrainian. It's just a historical European emigration and demographic shift. It's going to be very difficult for the Poles to deal with all of them.
Aglaya, obviously Poland and various other Western nations have promised to help Ukraine, but are there signs that the weapons and all the rest of it that have been promised have come through?
So a couple of weeks ago, there was a chatter about potentially the Poles sending in their fighter jets, their MiGs to Ukraine in order to resupply the Ukrainians, and the Americans handing them over F-16s. That actually has not taken place. There was also chat about the questions of whether or not the Poles and other East European countries can send in their own troops and whether or not, for example, the Americans would approve that, not as a NATO operation, but a sort of a so-called coalition of the willing. At this stage, it seems that Washington is not in favor of that. So, however, there has been a large military supplying of the Ukrainian armed forces. And one of the reasons why they are, you know, able to push the Russians back is that the resupplying has been significant. And the support in terms of intelligence operations has also been significant. So the military support has been stepped up over the course of this war, and it will continue. We will see what will come out of the American-EU summit.
Mm. I mean,
tomorrow.
Vladislav, do you think that enough has been done?
I'm very grateful to be asked that question, because I have three sources here in Warsaw who told me over the last 24 years. These are Ukrainian and Polish political elites who tell me how frustrated they are with Washington, D.C. for vetoing the sending of offensive weapons. So the Biden administration is widely seen by Poles and some of the Ukrainians here as not doing what they need to be doing in terms of sending the offensive weapons. The Ukis, the Ukrainians, I say Ukis with love because I am one,
You shouldn't say that if you're not one. But my people, the Ukrainians, are winning the ground war in terms of the war of attrition. But in order to really win, they need to get on a counteroffensive, which means tanks, which means really heavy weaponry, which means planes, which means more ballistic missiles, and all that stuff. The Biden administration has quietly vetoed giving to them, and that also means NATO not being allowed to give them. So the Poles, and I do have some very good sources, the Polish government here, who have told me quietly, discreetly, of their frustration without names. They're very happy for me to say it out loud. They're very, very unhappy with the Biden administration's stalling on this. And they see it as a kind of double game where literally the Biden administration wants a long-term or a medium-term reset with Moscow.
Avila, what do you think Putin's next moves might be? I mean, I'm wondering particularly if Russia could be eyeing the Suwalki Gap on the Poland-Lithuania border, because, of course, that's one of NATO's most vulnerable points, and it would cut the Baltic nations off from the rest of Europe and give Russia a pathway through Belarus to its occupied territory of Kaliningrad.
So, I mean, I think at this stage, you know, the question is essentially what is happening now, what is going to happen in 2 weeks. At the moment, the assumption is that once Mariupol falls, effective in the next, you know, day or two, the strategy will move more towards east. And the assumption would be that you will have the pincer movement coming from the sort of from Donbass and up from Mariupol in order to try and encircle the Ukrainian forces. At this stage, the Russians do not seem to have the capacity to essentially for much more advancement. If you're looking at the map, it hasn't changed much over the last, you know, couple of weeks. Then the focus on Kyiv is ongoing, but they're not able to encircle it. I think the strategy is more kind of the same, but heavier military focus on the east. But we are coming to, as everyone's been talking about, but I think it's still an issue, the questions of resupplying and a question of sort of a pause in the military offensive in order to regroup. And this will come over the next sort of couple of weeks, simply because, you know, forces will need to be regrouped. They're tired. You do also have the question of the spring draft in Russia and whether or not, for example, what is going to be the position of the conscripts that will be brought into the Russian army. So I'm not sure that the focus is going to go westwards. Mm. Although they are targeting certain key sort of military installations, they're also sort of using it as a signaling messaging effectively to the American administration to ensure that, you know, as Vladislav said, that the Americans continue on the path that they're in, which is sort of give defensive weapons, not get too involved on the ground, focus more on the sort of the global economic front against Russia rather than getting engaged militarily on the ground.
And Vladislav, finally, do you think that Russia can rely on Belarus for help? I mean, there are signs there that the military might refuse orders to fight in Ukraine, just as the conscripts from Russia, as Aglaya says, may too.
Yes, I've been watching the Belarus-Ukrainian relationship and writing about it for 2 years. I'm fascinated by it. And it was obvious already to us a year ago, but the most like six of us watching it, because it's not a very popular thing to watch. It was obvious that they were going to renege on their deals with the Ukrainians, and that they would be used as cannon fodder by the Russians, by Moscow. Obviously, Lukashenko does not want to do this. Clearly, it could even pose another issue of survival, regime survival for him. His regime is very brittle. It's not a very big army, first of all, the Belarusian army. It's not very modern. It's never deployed outside of its bases, outside of the borders of Belarus. Frankly, they're mostly useless. I mean, 20,000 more troops of guns would make a difference, but not a tremendous difference. It would mean that the Ukrainians would have to put more resources to the north and to defend uselessly territory outside of Lutsk or outside of Rovne, places like that in the north, on the close, not far from the Belarus border. I hope it doesn't happen. I don't see what capacity the Belarusians have to add in terms of added value. I think Lukashenko would have to be forced into doing so by Moscow. He's very wily and cunning. He's avoiding doing this. And, you know, it would just be more conscripts. It'd be more meat into the grinder. And the Ukrainians would be able to stop the onslaught. But I don't, it's not a good thing, of course, but I don't think it's going to happen. Or I hope I don't think it's going to happen. And it's not very useful.
Vladislav Davidson and Aglaya Snetkov there. Thank you both very much indeed. Bulgaria, a member of both the EU and NATO, is in a difficult position, torn between East and West and the fear of angering the Kremlin. After the Russian invasion of Ukraine, old divisions have been exacerbated, and the new Prime Minister, Kirill Petkov, finds himself treading a fine line. Well, joining me for more on this is Sofia-based journalist Boryana Jambozova. Thank you very much for joining us, Boryana. Could you tell us about the historic ties binding Bulgaria and Russia?
Good morning to you and to your listeners. So basically Bulgaria harbors deep ties with Russia dating back, from centuries ago. Oftentimes Russians are greeted as liberators because after centuries of Ottoman rule, Bulgaria was liberated in 1878 with the help of Russia. And even sometimes, Bulgarian poets and writers refer to Russia as a brotherly nations. Some poems refer to them, again, as liberators. But there are also, cultural ties. We use the same alphabet, the Cyrillic alphabet, as Russia, religion, etc., etc. But in modern times, increasingly, Bulgaria has been very much dependent on Russian gas and oil. During the communist times, Bulgaria was, in fact, one of the closest satellites of the Soviet Union. So after the fall of the Iron Curtain, these dependencies, further developed, and mainly because oligarchs and people linked to the former communist regime were still, in power.
I mean, is it true, do you think, to say that Moscow's a Trojan horse in the EU? That's a true description of Bulgaria.
I mean, some people do make that comparison. Bulgaria, just to make that distinction, is a member of the European Union and NATO for quite a while now. We joined the bloc in 2007. But at the same time, ever since or even prior that, Bulgarian governments have been very careful to, keep close ties with Brussels, but even closer ties with Moscow, because of this historical and economic and energy dependencies.
So how has Petkov then and the government there reacted to the invasion of Ukraine? How much help are they prepared to give the country? Because, as you say, they're so dependent on Russian energy. I mean, are sanctions being imposed?
When Petkov's government took over last December, I don't think anybody, of course, was prepared to deal with that, but he was quick to condemn the war. But at the same time, when he won the general election last year, he didn't win enough votes to form his own government. So now we have a four-party coalition government, and a member of that government are the socialists, who are the successor of the former Communist Party. And of course, there is no surprise there that they are against sanctions against Russia, and they're kind of having this pro-Russian rhetoric in their party line. So basically, Petkov found himself in a very difficult position, because while he was quick and very strongly condemned the war and Bulgaria joined EU in supporting the sanctions against Russia, he also have to balance this kind of delicate domestic coalition, which, if it goes to extremes, it might topple the government, even though observers are saying that that's not the fact. That's not a threat at the moment. And at the same time, as you said, Bulgaria is dependent on Russian gas and energy, so he might be looking to have an exception from the general EU policy and sanctions in this area.
And what do the general public in Bulgaria feel? Do they support Russia or Ukraine?
That's a difficult question. Actually, a recent poll conducted just a few days after the start of the war, or after Russia invaded Ukraine, we see a significant drop in support of Vladimir Putin. So from 55% of Bulgarians who supported him in the summer of last year, now only 32% have a favorable view on him. But at the same time, when you talk to, friends of friends, relatives, especially people in small towns, there's still this lingering sentiment of support to Russia despite the invasion. So it's too early to say whether this, blow to Putin's image will stick, or this will be just a temporary phenomenon.
And finally, Boryana, I just wonder how strong Russian propaganda is in Bulgaria.
Yeah, I wanted to add a note on that. On social media, it's really extraordinary. I mean, we can see Western propaganda Russian propaganda in Western media and Western countries. But here it's really rampant. And Bulgaria has been a testing ground for this kind of conspiracy theories fueled by the Kremlin for years. So now it's really easy to activate those pro-Kremlin trolls and, tell people that it's the U.S. or NATO to blame for the war, etc. But again, just wanted to point out that observers are saying that, when you're shelling civilians and residential buildings in Ukraine, there's no way that this will not alter the perception of Bulgarians towards Russia.
Boryana, thank you very much indeed. That's Boryana Jambazova. Still to come in the programme, we'll examine the passenger plane crash in China, find out why South Korea's president-elect is rejecting the Blue House, and...
Somebody came up with, shouldn't Eurovision be in the US?
No, you said that.
We'll hear about the American Song Contest and its Eurovision roots. This is The Globalist.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
"132 people have feared dead after a passenger plane crashed in the southwest of China. Greg Waldron is Asia Managing Editor of Flight Global, and he joins me now. Good morning to you, Greg. We've seen terrifying footage of the plane heading down vertically. What more do we know about this incident?
Hi, Georgina. This is a very bizarre and, terrifying episode. We know very little about what happened. I mean, the aircraft was about 3/4 of the way into the flight. Flight tracking suggests everything's normal at about 30,000 feet. And then suddenly the aircraft just plunges to earth. And now, of course, we're seeing, very fuzzy dash cam footage of the aircraft, crashing into the mountainside and the fires raging. And we really know a little more beyond that. So it's really going to take an investigation to really figure out what happened with this aircraft.
What could make a plane behave in this way? Surely it's extremely unusual for it to plummet in that vertical way as seen on the dash cam footage.
Yeah, it certainly is. You know, a few notable things about this. From my understanding, at least the Chinese haven't said so, there is no evidence that a distress call or any sort of mayday call went out. So it's safe to assume that whatever happened seemed to have, you know, caught the crew by surprise. Everything was fine 1 minute, and then it seems suddenly, you know, there was this catastrophic situation happening. I wouldn't want to speculate on what could happen, but obviously something, you know, major happened with the aircraft. Could be a number of, you know, aircraft is a very complex system. A number of things could have gone wrong. And, you know, it's really going to depend on, you know, finding the flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder. And then we'll be able to start to put together what happened.
What kind of aircraft was it?
Well, it was a 737-800. And this is an earlier generation of the 737. Maybe, you know, they were producing it up until a few years ago when it was subsequently replaced by the, you know, 737 MAX, which, of course, you know, has gained a certain notoriety because of the two fatal crashes and the long grounding of this type. But this is a 737-800, so it's not related to the MAX, because even though they look the same and they're the same family, they are quite different aircraft in some ways.
Mm. So I wonder what that means for Boeing then, given the previous history of the 737 MAX.
Well, it's certainly, you know, terrible. I think, you know, Boeing and Airbus are always going to be, you know, alarmed when there's a safety incident regarding their aircraft. So I think, you know, Boeing's first step is going to be to really, you know, provide, you know, expertise and technical assistance with this. And of course, you know, Boeing, the USA, the engine maker as well, CFM are going to be really interested in, you know, exploring and seeing, you know, what actually happened. And I think the real focus initially is going to be if they can quickly determine what exactly happened, to then go back and look at the in-service 737-800 fleet to see if, you know, other aircraft need a certain maintenance fix or this or that. They really have to, they're really going to be looking at this with the chat, with the idea of making sure it doesn't happen again in the future.
Mm. And I wonder how more broadly the aviation industry is reacting to this.
Well, it's certainly going to be, you know, a shock to the industry. Now, you know, the industry's been had a really tough year, few years owing to COVID-19. And one, you know, aspect of COVID-19, given that there was so few aircraft actually flying during this period, is we just statistically saw, you know, fewer safety incidents. Now, of course, as people travel more, as air traffic picks up, you're going to start seeing, you know, probably more safety episodes, if not outright crashes. But it's certainly, you know, it's going to be, this is the first major disaster after COVID-19, and it's going to bring, you know, aviation safety again back to the forefront of people's minds.
Mm. And finally, does China generally have a good aviation safety record?
Yeah, for the last few years, they've been very safe. I mean, it's been, you know, it's a very tightly run ship. I mean, it's a very tightly controlled. They're really concerned about safety. You'll recall that they were the first ones to suspend the 737 MAX, and they were also the last ones to really allow that to come back into service. Unfortunately, though, they do have a tendency to be fairly secretive with, you know, the findings of, you know, safety investigations, whereas maybe, you know, Western countries would be a bit more open about, you know, the findings of a safety review. China would tend to keep it secret. And also there are some concerns that the culture in China and other similar type countries where it's a real command and control type, you know, country, they'll tend to be to take the focus. If somebody made a safety mistake, they'll be punished. And therefore, whereas in the West, the approach is there's a safety issue, you know, nobody gets punished, but we learn from it, we think about it, and we, you know, really report on it. So sometimes there's been concerns that safety issues might actually happen in China, but they're not reported because people are fearful of retribution.
Greg, thank you very much indeed. That's Greg Waldron from Flight Global. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Ukraine's military has said residents should brace for more indiscriminate Russian shelling of critical infrastructure focused around the southern port city of Mariupol. Ukraine said yesterday it would not obey ultimatums from Russia after Moscow demanded it stop defending besieged Mariupol, where hundreds of thousands of civilians continue to suffer through Russian bombardments. US President Joe Biden has warned that Moscow is considering using chemical weapons. Without citing evidence, Biden said Russia's false accusations that Kyiv had biological and chemical weapons illustrated that Russian President Vladimir Putin was considering using them himself. Biden is due to travel to Europe this week for meetings with allied leaders to discuss tighter sanctions on Russia. And Hong Kong prepares to lift flight bans. On April the 1st, nine countries, including Britain, France and the United States, will be given the green light, with some quarantine measures halved to 7 days. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said the bans were no longer compatible with Hong Kong's socio-economic needs. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. The Blue House in Seoul has long been the seat of power in South Korea, where the leader both lives and works. However, the president-elect, Yoon Suk-yeol, plans to move his centre of operations to a defence ministry compound at an estimated cost of $40 million. Well, on the line is Stephen Borowick, who is a journalist in Seoul and a contributing writer for Nikkei Asian Review. Stephen, thanks for joining us. How is this decision by the president-elect being justified?
As we speak, I'm actually looking at an office window in Seoul at the Blue House, and the way that it sits in the city is kind of partway up a mountain, and it appears to sort of peer down on the city, and it has this historic symbolism as being the sort of seat of imperial power and a place from where not super democratic leaders projected their power onto a relatively helpless citizenry. So, I mean, Yoon is far from the first. The current president, Moon Jae-in, when he took office, he said something kind of similar. He said that he would move his office to a government complex just across the street, and that he would, you know, be a man of the people, and he would walk to work and shake hands and kiss babies on the way. But what's different about Yoon is that he seems pretty steadfast in that he's actually going to go through with this, and he's picked, as you mentioned in your intro, he's picked this candidate site across the city in this location that's like not super convenient for the affairs of a president, and this is going to come at some pretty steep financial costs. And what critics of this decision are pointing to right now is that Yoon is saying that he will do this because this is a way to reduce the authoritarian associations of the president and be more open and be more democratic. But he's decided this, you know, he's not even president yet. And so he's decided this without really any input from the other political parties or without putting this up to any kind of public debate. So even though he will not take office as president until May 10th, he's already creating some headaches for himself.
I mean, just looking at the history of the building, we are told that it may be unlucky. Dozens of ancient kings worked and lived elsewhere, and more recently, four out of the six presidents in the country's 25-year democratic history have been imprisoned or committed suicide after leaving office. So might this have influenced Yoon?
It might have. I mean, he's trying to downplay any kind of immaterial or metaphysical motivations for his decision. You know, he said that this is all a kind of cold and rational decision, and that he's doing this because he wants to create a new break in the country's politics. But you know, if you look at the history, I mean, all of those presidents, the things that they were guilty of really had nothing to do with where they were living. It was all about the way that they carried on as politicians and some of the extracurricular activities they partook in. So, I mean, I think any kind of astute observer of the country's politics will be at pains to point out that how Yoon's presidency ultimately go ahead will not be determined by where he lives. It'll come down to the kind of policies that he enacts and who he chooses to surround himself with and whose advice he chooses to take.
Well, nevertheless, though, during his campaign, he was accused of coming under the sway of a shaman. And a lot of people are saying that this is, in fact, influenced by the same person and the fact that he feels there might be bad feng shui.
Yeah, and he held this press conference on Sunday where he said that he used this phrase that translates as one's physical surroundings can dominate the way that one thinks. And so there was a kind of allusion to if he or if any other president is living in this place and conducting the affairs of state from this place that has these historic associations with authoritarianism, that will inevitably kind of bleed over into how they behave. And if he moves his office into a more nondescript government building, then he will, you know, behave more just like a regular public servant, and he will behave with the more mundane concerns of government on his mind, and he will not think of himself as being in any way above the people. You know, like I said, I'm looking at the Blue House right now, and it's quite a compelling image in the way that it sits on the face of this mountain, but it does, you know, kind of look down on the city in a way that has an association that a lot of people don't really like.
Mm. So I wonder how secure and efficient the new premises will be, and if the cost and the disruption of moving can be justified.
That remains to be seen. It's only, you know, he's going to take office on May 10th, and he's saying that he's going to push to have this all done by then. He says that he chose the defense ministry because it already has a pretty well-developed security infrastructure. But the question is, the current administration have said that they don't like this plan and they're not going to cooperate with it. I wonder the extent to which the military in Korea is this like famously insular organization that, you know, tends not to cooperate with other government bodies unless it really has to. I mean, I wonder how much they're going to be happy to go along with this, or if they may throw a wrench in this plan or not. But just, you know, the kind of quick way of looking at this is, it just seems like this is it at a time when North Korea is making noise again. This is at a time when there's quite a few Omicron cases coming out every day here, and the economy is still struggling. The question is this going to really be worth Yoon's political capital? If this is something that he has to fight the opposition for, if this is something that he really needs to work to convince the public of, you know, is this ultimately going to be worth it? Because, like I said, he hasn't even taken office yet. And presumably he's got a whole bunch of policy mandates that he wants to get forth. And he does not have a majority in the National Assembly. So it seems to me like he's making things quite difficult on himself just from the outset.
Steve, thanks very much indeed. That was Stephen Borowick. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. It's 8:37 in Zurich, that's 7:37 here in London, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me down the line is Stephanie Bolzan, who is UK correspondent for Die Welt. Good morning to you, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Now, the big story here in Britain beyond Ukraine is the release of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who, of course, was held for 6 years and has just flown back to Britain. She's given a press conference in which she has blamed the foreign secretaries who've all been trying to get her freedom.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And I mean, after all, this is a bit of good news. I think this was the one story in Britain that everybody was happy around when she was released last week. And so yesterday she did her first press conference together with her husband, Richard Zaghari Ratcliffe, who had been for 6 years relentlessly being active to get her out of prison. And but his wife, she was very critical of the British government. And for me, what was key was that she said, even already in the second or third week that she was in prison, she was told something like, oh, we want something of the Brits. We will not let you go until such time that we get it. And that was this historic debt of £400 million from a weapons deal back in the 1970s. And she made the point, why did it take 5 foreign secretaries to free her if that always had been the case? So she really expressed her lack of power to be in the prison, and knowing that she was completely dependent on international disagreements like the nuclear power deal or that historic debt. So, but in the end, I must say, it is still wonderful that she's finally freed.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, she's right in that debt could have been paid so 6 years ago.
Yes, of course. And it's still not clear why it wasn't. And of course, there are much bigger, complex questions. How much was that somehow part of a package with the nuclear power deal? Then, of course, we know how much turmoil the region is in, how many economic and political interests there are, the effects of sanctions. So she just became a pawn in a very, very frustrating and for her terrible game, because she lost 6 years of her life. She didn't see her daughter for 6 years or almost 6 years, and her husband. But she said, I mean, this woman is just amazing. She said she got off the plane and all this hurt. She's trying to leave it on the plane and move on and not be resentful about having lost these 6 years of precious 6 years of her life.
And of course, she's still fighting for the release of another hostage who's in custody.
Yes, of course, there's still, and there are, of course, far more political hostages and prisoners in Iran. But this is another, I mean, she was released with Anousheh Ashoori, so another British prisoner who had been in Iran, who was released with her. Now there's another British-American prisoner. And the question is whether the fact that he also has an American passport makes him even a better, well, pray for the Iranians to get something, squeeze something out of negotiations with Washington.
Yeah. Now, let's stay with nuclear, actually, because nuclear industry bosses have had a meeting with Boris Johnson. What came out of that?
Well, this is a very interesting development. I know we have so much news going on, but this is one of the things, of course, we all ask ourselves everywhere, whether it's in Germany or in Britain or beyond, how are we going to pay our electricity and energy bills? Only in Britain, now in April, average British household bills go up from around £700 to almost £2,000. And we are expecting even higher rises or more rises in October. So, of course, Britain still has 11 nuclear power sites, but most of them need to be decommissioned. I think only one is actually still young enough, so to say, to keep working. So by the end of this decade, they have to be decommissioned. And we know that there were a lot of talks in the last years of building new nuclear power stations. There was a lot of political problems and challenges for the British government because Chinese investors were involved, and then that was decided that they shouldn't be involved in this anymore. So yeah, Boris Johnson had heads of nuclear power companies in, and he is very keen to build new ones or to modernize the ones that that there are here in Britain, and he wants to rise or to have by 2050 25% of British energy coming from nuclear power stations.
And of course, he really needs to do that because the energy price cap, according to the Telegraph, is set to climb 54% in April. That means British average household bills will go from 693 now to 1,971. That's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. But of course, I mean, modernizing or even building a nuclear power station takes much, much longer. So I think on the short run, nuclear power will not make any difference. It's also important to say that, of course, nuclear power comes into the mix of the targets of the British government to fulfill net zero targets in the fight against climate change. So that's another point. And as we know, Boris Johnson was now at the forefront of fighting against global warming. So that's why he also needs nuclear power to in the mix. But the problem is for investors that it's incredibly expensive to build or modernize nuclear power stations. So it looks like what the British government's plan is that there's a new financing mechanism for nuclear power plants so that developers get costs back during the construction of the plant and not only at the end of it.
Let's turn finally to your own paper, Die Welt, and we're looking at Germany's embarrassment over arms deliveries to Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a story that actually my paper has been chasing quite a lot. And that's the question. As we all know, there has been an historic turnaround by the German government to say we invest now billions into defense because of Vladimir Putin's war in Ukraine, and also Germany has been starting to deliver weapons to Ukraine. But if you really look how much that has been, it's actually rather poor. So at the very beginning, Germany delivered 1,000 rocket-propelled grenades and also anti-missile rockets, I think 500. But since then, it has been actually a very thin stream of deliveries to Ukraine. There were 2,700 more air defense systems promised, but so far there have been only 500 delivered. And the German government is very intransparent what they are delivering. They have now said, well, there's this European Union fund. It's called the peace, a kind of peace fund. It was now, I think yesterday, they stocked it up from 500 million euro to over €1 billion for Ukraine to get weapons. But it goes very slowly. And that on the background that actually Germany is the fourth biggest weapons exporter in the whole world. And last year exported weapons of the value of 9 billion euro to other countries. So the question is, why does it take so long? Why is it so difficult? And Germany really has to step up.
Mm. Stephanie, thank you very much indeed. That's Stephanie Bolzan. And this is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Last night saw the inaugural edition of the American Song Contest hit television screens in the US. The competition will pit musical acts from every state against each other in what's been dubbed the American answer to Eurovision. But how do you even attempt to adapt such a unique cultural phenomenon to an American audience? Well, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco recently spoke to Krista Bjorkman and Anders Lenhoff, the Swedish producers of the show, to find out a little more. Fernando began by asking Krista what his connection to the Eurovision world is.
Okay, so my history starts as a viewer, as a kid, way back. Then I competed for Sweden in 1992, and then I became a producer of the Swedish selection show in 2001. So I spent 20 years doing that. And during those 20 years, I also had the honor of producing the contest of the Eurovision five times. And then I dragged this man into it in 2017, to help me sort out the Eurovision in Ukraine.
So my story is a lot shorter. Yes, I did watch it as a kid. Did I want to perform? No. I've been a TV, I'm more of a generic TV person. I've been in television as a director, scriptwriter, and producer since the early 90s. I co-produced Melody Festival in Sweden with Krista in 2015. That's sort of when I entered that world. I did that as an admirer, I have to say. I think that what Krista did for the Swedish show was outstanding. I mean, it still is by far the biggest show and the most spectacular. And that came out of a period of being not so great and was completely turned around. So I really enjoyed doing that. And then one day Krista calls me and says, can you come visit? which ended up with me being a show producer for Eurovision 2017. And then out of that actually was this project born in some ways, because this came out of post-drinks with me, Krista, and Ola Melsig, who was also in Kiev, just talking about things we'd like to do. Somebody came up with, shouldn't Eurovision be in the US?
No, you said that. And I was like, yeah, right. And then he wouldn't give up. He just kept on talking about it. And then he's like, oh, well, let's do it. That's sort of what happened.
Yeah, right.
How challenging it is to make the American Song Contest, because you both come from kind of an European perspective because of Eurovision. How challenging is this adaptation to the American market?
I think you both answers are good, but definitely we had to make some adjustments, but not as much because of the market. I would say it's more about having a very, very old format that has been around for such a long time. It has a lot of elements in it that you have to question. You know, it's like, would this work if you do it from the beginning now? And the answer sometimes is no, One, it's not necessary. Two, it's a bit old-fashioned. You don't have to do it that way. So it was very much about turning every stone and looking at each and every segment of the show to see, is it feasible today, or can we do it in another way that feels more modern, more up-to-date, and also in the tempo of today? Because a lot of things, I mean, you know, you could question if it's okay to listen to 42 stars stealing time from the show, talking about themselves, when actually all we need to know is who wants to have the 12 points. That's all we want. But we get a lot of other stuff as well. And it takes about an hour. And that is not how you do modern TV.
As Chris said, I mean, it's like, I don't think you could make Eurovision happen in Europe today if it hadn't been around 65 years. And that's the challenge, right? Because Eurovision hasn't been around in the US. They haven't had anything even remotely like it. So you have to adjust it to make it sure that it actually works. And it's also from a commercial standpoint, sellable. I mean, so Eurovision, speaking of turning every stone, but Eurovision is three shows in 1 week. That doesn't work in the TV landscape. If you want a big network like NBC to put this show on, it needs to, it's not like they have blank spaces in their programming. They're going to take something away, in this case, The Voice, one season of The Voice, and they're going to replace that with something, with the new thing, in this case, us. Meaning we need to, this needs to be a season. So it's eight shows instead of three. It's 8 weeks instead of one. And that's some of the adjustments you need to do, hopefully to make it better, but also to make it happen.
Also, this is a big country. And to get room with all the states and the territories, you need a longer period of time.
Yep.
And one thing that I think would be very interesting for the American audience is that there's no competition like this in the country where they can be proud about their state, you know, like state against state, like, you know, like this political side that we see on Eurovision as well.
You are so right. You're so correct. It's actually incredible when you start listening to all these artists that have been selected, when they talk about their home state or their parents' home state or where they went to college or whatever, you know, that the love is genuine and the pride is genuine. They are really, really, you know, so happy to be part of this and to be able to represent their state. It's very beautiful to see.
You're so right on the money. It's one of the things that's been said so many times during this process. And that's also why we get artists on an entirely different level than the talent show, because it's not a talent show, right? It's about representing your home. It's not about becoming an artist. It's about being an artist. Be there to make, because you're proud to represent Maine, or make the people of Maine proud that you're representing them.
That's Krista Bjorkman and Anders Lenhoff speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And to hear the interview in full, listen to the latest American Song Contest themed episode of Monocle on Culture. You can get that from our website. You're with The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, it's time now to get the latest TV news with the critic and broadcaster Scott Bryan. Scott, you were listening to that Eurovision interview. Are you a Eurovision fan?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I find that I can only really get into Eurovision during Eurovision week, you know, that weird week in May where you are subjected to amazing, bizarre, creative and incredibly addictive songs that happen. I watch the semi-finals, of course, because there's semi-finals before the main final of the Eurovision Song Contest. So I think in regards to the American version, the American Song Contest, the challenge is the fact that it's on for successive weeks, as you were just hearing in that interview. So I wonder whether it will have the stamina, particularly that I was looking at the listings for last night's first episode. And they have a advert break, being America, an advert break after every single American performance. I'm quite relieved that with the Eurovision Song Contest, they don't do that. Otherwise, we'll be there till 4 a.m.
But I mean, part of the joy of Eurovision on British television is the commentary by Graham Norton and before him, Terry Wogan. And I wonder if this sort of celebration of camp needs witty narration to bring it alive to an audience. And if that's something Americans can do, I mean, it strikes me as a very different type of humour.
Yeah, totally. I mean, what I find fascinating is how America gets confused by Eurovision just because it's so much all over the social media feeds on the week that it's coming out of Europe. And there have been attempts for quite a while to have America participating in it in terms of actually watching the coverage itself. And so far, the coverage has primarily been, as well as this separate spin-off contest, is that they've been able to show the actual contest itself on the streaming service Peacock. But that doesn't come with any commentary at all. So you don't get any representative from the US providing that sass, those one-liners, that self-deprecation or analysis. And I think it loses something because you need that. You need it. It's like watching it with a friend on the sofa who's able to give you context, but also are able to poke fun at it. And it's a contest that we like to make fun of, but it's also just nice to participate in.
Yeah. Now, talking about streaming, a horrific story here. Golden Age of streaming could cost viewers up to £2,500 a year. That's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I mean, this is if you have got every access to every streaming service to watch all of the shows that are available. You know, if you want to watch the Champions League final, if you want to watch the latest high-end dramas coming from HBO, if you are going to be watching the latest Netflix drama. And of course, we all know that you have to have different streaming services. There are new ones coming up all the time. ITV have announced in the UK that they're announcing their own called ITVX, which actually saw their share price plummet because I think there's a lack of confidence and thinking that they would be able to enter this market when there is already so many other streaming services. And I think it points down to the fact that at the end of the day, we need to pay for these streaming services for the actual cost that these providers have spent on the content. And they're all using debt to essentially prop up their service. And if you look at the details, I mean, although that we have had, according to research from Ender's analysis, 130,000 hours worth of content from streamers and video on demand offerings in the last year, compared to only 30,000 as recently as 2016, we've also been having price increases. Netflix increased their price in the UK for the second time in 2 years, which means that roughly now, if you've got the premium offering, which is allows you to watch in super high definition, is actually costing more than a TV license, the actual fee that all UK households have to pay to watch TV anyway. So I think some people are thinking, well, you know, it's starting to really add up, particularly that as the pandemic rules have eased slightly, people are able to leave the house. They're not watching as much TV as they used to.
Yeah. Well, of course, we're getting slightly less choice than we used to have because the news channel Russia Today, or RT, has had its licence revoked here in Britain.
Yes. So this happened, you know, there's been, RT has not been available to watch in the UK for quite some time, primarily just because of the feed that was coming from the channel, was coming from Luxembourg and France, and the EU separately banned RT across the state. So on the same day, we weren't able to go and have that feed from the channel anymore. But what essentially Ofcom, the UK regulator, has now said is that they are not going to be giving them a license. They've revoked the license, which means that RT would not be able to broadcast at all for, you know, years to come. I think what is interesting is if you look at the Russian embassy in the UK, they tweeted, quote, the Russian side reserves its right as per normal international practice to respond respectively in regards to the activity of British media in Russia. So that basically implies, you know, what would happen to the BBC journalists reporting within Russia. Of course, there's been news coming out about tightening restrictions on what you can and cannot report there. Media freedom has been incredibly restrained over the last few months since the start of the Russia invasion of Ukraine. So I think it will raise questions about what will happen to other British and international media reporting from within Russia that are just trying to get the facts. Will they be having a consequence because of the propaganda that RT was releasing being banned here in the UK?
Yeah, thank you very much indeed, Scott. That was Scott Bryan. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds and Charlie Filmer-Court, our researchers, Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett, and our studio manager, Christy Evans, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. Now, after the headlines, there's more music on the way. There's also Monocle Reads with Brian Appleyard, who's written a wonderful sociological history of the car. And following that, I'll be speaking to John Happ on Meet the Writers. His book, The Navigation Case, is about a huge air victory for the US forces that hardly anyone's ever heard of. The briefing is live at midday in London, and The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.